Kathy, thank you for that introduction. I always love having the expectations set up here, and I can do my best to drag them down back to their appropriate level. Let me just start off with a quick quiz, actually. Well, no, let me start with the most important thing, my disclosures. None. Okay, now I'll start with my quick quiz. So how many of you, when you were kids, walked to school? Raise your hand. And everybody take a look around, because I've actually seen this survey done quite a bit. So take a look around, look at the results. All right, hands down. Now, raise your hand if your kids walk to school. Okay, and thank you. So we had four hands go up. Obviously, there was a big difference there, and obviously, since you all are data geeks from the health community, you know my sample wasn't quite right. But the point is the same everywhere you go. And if you eliminate the people who don't have kids from the survey, et cetera, it always looks the same. And there are some interesting reasons behind this, and this really gets to sort of the core of my talk, which is the relationship between how we build our communities and how we act within them. And so this is an interesting little study that was done by the South Carolina Coastal Conservation League. And what they wanted to know is, so the biggest barrier to walking to school actually for kids is distance to school. If it's a really long way, you don't walk. But they wanted to know, for kids who actually live close enough to walk, what is the prevalence of hazard busing? And that's when you live close enough to walk, but it's too dangerous. There's a dump site, there's a large arterial, something is between you and school that makes it too dangerous, and therefore we spend a lot of money busing kids around and they don't get to walk. And what they did is they did a very simple thing. They just asked, when was the school built? And if it was built before 1950, you can see that you had very low rates of hazard busing. And if it was built more recently, you can tell that we got better and better at putting schools in dangerous locations. And, of course, that means the kids aren't as physically active and that we're spending money on busing. So that works out pretty well. So it's an interesting thing. And if you're deep into transportation or any number of other topics, you know that land use is sort of the start. And it makes a lot of sense. If you're trying to figure out how people act from a transportation perspective, you want to know, well, where are they and where are they trying to go? Pretty simple stuff. And we can make it a lot more complicated with models and so forth. But it turns out we're actually relatively confused about land use to begin with and how it is supposed to interact. So here, we're not sure what the sidewalk is for. You're going to run directly into that pole. Presumably, you're just visiting the tree on the either one of these little walks that you have going here. No school kids walk up here because they don't want to look stupid. I mean, you just wouldn't do it. I don't really know that it needs any narration. So they're going in there to use the Stairmaster, but won't climb the stairs to get there. we're pretty confused about sort of the relationship between how we use the environment and what we're supposed to be doing, and really even who we're building places for. And I'm sure many of you have seen these slides before, but building an environment where the dog can walk but the people can't. So this is where I think smart growth got a lot of its impetus. And, of course, this session is smart growth. What's it all about? It got a lot of its impetus from starting to understand that there have been some real strange impacts from the way that we've been building our communities. And the most important thing to know about smart growth is that it's about outcomes. So I'm going to talk about a lot of the sort of physical dimensions of smart growth, but it's really about thinking about how we're building our communities, our neighborhoods, and asking ourselves, can we do better? Can we do better from a community livability standpoint, from a health standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from an environment standpoint? And I think the overwhelming answer when people ask themselves that in communities around the country is, yes, we can do better. And it often ends up looking similar. The solutions that they end up finding for themselves look similar. They want to create more walkable places. They want to have a lot of transportation choices rather than just one. They need a lot of housing choices because what they need when they have kids and families is different than right after they got out of school or when they're aging and the kids have left. They want to preserve their open space. They want a unique character of place and so on. All the things that normal, sensible people talk about when they talk about their neighborhoods. We can start to put this into physical form, and this is Arlington County, Virginia. This is a sort of big metro area example, but it applies equally to small towns as well. So you can see here at a kind of corridor regional scale, D.C., the D.C. area made a big investment in metro. that metro rail runs right up the spine of this corridor. This used to be a single-story strip development along an arterial. Over the past 30 years or so, it's been built up in coordination with the big transportation investment. That means we get a lot of big return on that investment, while at the same time, at the edges, you still have low-density single-family housing. So you have a lot of housing choices, a lot of transportation choices. The folks who are living in those edges, though, benefit from the fact that they have retail and services and restaurants and other things close by because that center corridor has the density of customers that will allow you to support that. It allows you to support great transportation. It allows you to support great land uses. And so you have sort of the benefits of both worlds. And if you come out of college, you really like to move into some of those apartments that are immediately above restaurants or offices or other things in that middle corridor. And then as you have kids and you need more land, you can still stay in the neighborhood. You can just move over a couple blocks to a single-family residential house. And that's the kind of choices, both housing and transportation, amenities and so forth, that we're looking for in smart growth. At the neighborhood level, the top represents how we've been building communities for the last 50 or 60 years, basically since the post-World War II environment. The development community has become very sort of one-product oriented. So you have office park developers, you have mall developers, you have residential developers, you have apartment developers, and so forth. And they all take their little pod and do their pod of development and then ask the traffic engineers to somehow figure out how to get between them. And you can see that the fact that the arterial, which is that middle road, doesn't work so well is entirely because you can't get from one pod to the other. Every trip you're taking on that top neighborhood and those top developments, come down on that arterial, clog it up with all kinds of left and right turns and crazy motions, and so that doesn't work, so we widen that street and things go down. The bottom is how we more traditionally built neighborhoods. You can get from one part of the neighborhood to the other. You can keep the speed slow because if you're only traveling 3/4 of a mile or a mile or 2 miles, it doesn't really matter if you're going 15 miles an hour. It's a short trip. But when you have to extend your trip and go long distances, then you have to go with speed, and that speed doesn't work well in residential neighborhoods. At the street level, this is what it might look like, and these are going to be familiar to, you know, if you've seen other sessions on community design or even the session previous to this, but we're talking about a lot of features that make for good pedestrian, biking, and auto environments, as well as transit. The higher density allows the transit to work. The close proximity of a bunch of places to go makes it a park once district. So you park, you walk to all your destinations, and then you leave. And the other scenario where you're parking and then going back out on the arterial and reparking just to go to multiple destinations also causes traffic problems. The parked cars by the curb create a nice sense of buffering for the pedestrians from the passing traffic. You've got the bike lanes, you've got the wide sidewalks, you've got the shade, you've got the street trees providing shade, and again, also a sense of buffering. You've got the mix of uses between housing and apartments and retail and residential and so forth. All of that is what you might find on this street. And this contrasts with what you'll more normally find around the country with the kinds of zoning and investments that we've made from a public policy standpoint, where we've said, in fact, it's illegal to have commercial and residential in the same place. We know we're going to have to accommodate all of those cars, so we're going to have super wide streets because we've designed it so everyone has to get on the arterial. Soon that we're going to have to get more traffic through here. We'll get that on-street parking out of the way, and that'll make it much less friendly for pedestrians. We require lower densities. The stores start to pull back from the street because everyone has to essentially drive to get to your store, and so you want a lot of parking. We don't treat the parking like a utility. Instead, everyone has to provide their own, and so you park, shop, drive around to the next, park, shop, drive around to the next, and create this kind of unwalkable environment. We know that makes a difference from a transportation standpoint. There have been aggregate studies which look at, I think that's Portland, Oregon on the left and Charlotte, North Carolina on the right, comparing two relatively same size regions but with very different patterns of development. And what you find when you compare those kinds of places against one another is that in aggregate you get about a 35% or on average about a 35% reduction in VMT, and that means both shorter car trips, but it also means more walking, biking, and transit trips. And of course, you all know that any transit trip begins and ends with a walking trip. because that's how you get to transit. Other studies, I'm not going to belabor this, but there are a number of different types of studies that have been done. This is in Chicago at the sort of more neighborhood level. They looked at the places that have a mix of uses, that are more walkable, that have destinations nearby and so forth, good pedestrian facilities, and find that basically if you're in the green areas where those characteristics are present, you walk a lot more, you drive a lot less, you take more transit and so forth. Similarly, there have been neighborhood-to-neighborhood comparisons. So these are relatively similar neighborhoods, just designed differently, but in the same general region. Again, a 40% reduction in vehicle miles of travel. You can see that the walk share goes up pretty significantly. The bike share is up a little, the bus share and so forth. One sort of traditional myth that people always talk about when they talk about Europe is they're like, oh, the transit there, the trains are so much better, which may be true, but where they actually really outperform us is on the walking. It's hugely on the walking. And so people really, they start to think, oh, this isn't going to work unless we have really high-quality transit and so forth. It is about creating the walkable places. And those places may evolve into a place with transit, and if they do, then they'll be transit-ready because you'll have designed them that way. But it's about the walking environments. This is a project in Atlanta that I did some work on, just looking at the difference in regional location of putting a pretty big, about a $4 billion development, either in the regional center at Atlantic Station or three other alternative locations. Basically, just the regional location accounted for about a 50% savings between that and the most far-flung locations, again, because your car trips are shorter, but you also have access to MARTA, which is the regional transit system, and you can walk and bike. It was interesting. We talked with the developer about the design. The original design is on the far left there. You can see that the housing is in the middle. The retail is on the left and the commercial is on the right, which meant that they did as much as they could to essentially separate the places people were going to work from the places they might actually have lunch. And we said, do you think that might, you know, people might want to come out of those offices and get lunch? And so they ended up with the design on the right, which more finely mixed all of those uses, and basically found just by changing that site design, you could reduce vehicle miles of travel by another 5%. Which, on a scale like that, you're really talking about a direct substitution of driving for walking in most cases. So that the regional accessibility is hugely important, but you can make improvements just on the basis of design. So to sum up, you can see the sort of logical progression between the built environment here at the top and health and obesity and other indicators of health outcomes. And that's the connection that we're talking about, is the opportunity to do more as part of your daily life, not so much in a recreational mode, but in the way I got here this morning. I walked from my house about 25 minutes down here to work today to give this talk. That was really nice. It's a great way to spend my morning. It doesn't fit well the traditional models of transportation. If I wanted to maximize my utility in modeling, I would have biked. That's the fastest way here. But for me, it's not enough exercise this morning. It's a 9-minute trip downhill, not helpful. So I decided I better walk in. But that actually counts as a less efficient, less return on investment trip in traditional transportation thinking. So there are a lot of ways that we can start to address this in the built environment. I want to give you a couple examples and then focus in on a couple. But the New Jersey Rehabilitation Code, they started to understand that the requirements they had for rehabbing existing buildings in more location-efficient parts of their regions was basically acting as a barrier, and that they shouldn't require the same things when you're doing a rehab as you would for new construction. They changed that, and they saw a big uptick in rehab and reuse. This is in Huntersville, North Carolina. They basically said, how do we increase density without really changing the feel of the neighborhood and address some homeowners, both changing demographics where you have smaller household sizes and existing homes, as well as maybe changing economics, and basically said, so the little unit on the right, we're going to allow you to rent that out now. And it turns out that can be a source of income, it can be a source of affordable housing, it can increase the densities and create opportunities for people to live in neighborhoods who couldn't maybe otherwise afford to live there. So that was an easy way without changing the character of the neighborhood at all. School setting is another place this comes in. I kind of started here and we come back to it, but there are some crazy rules that some, or rules of thumb if they're not actually rules. But some places say, all right, if it costs two-thirds as much to rebuild a school as it would, so if it's one-third more expensive to build a new one, you should build the new one. We'd rather you spent a lot more money just because generically we think new is better. And then when you do decide you have to build it new, we have these minimum acreage standards that we're going to apply, which might be 10 acres for an elementary school, it might be 20 for a middle school, and it might be 30 for a high school. So you know as soon as you're asking for 30 acres of land that you're looking for cheap land if you're a school district because you don't have a lot of money. And you know if you're looking for cheap land, you're looking for land in the middle of nowhere. And you know that, then you're imposing a lot of transportation costs on people, but you're glad because someone else is paying it, the state or somebody else. So you get to shove those costs on other people, you get to shove them on parents, but the overall equation, if you were to add all those costs together, doesn't make a bit of sense. Transit ballot initiatives, these are just local initiatives to raise money to pay for transit. We've got one coming up in Atlanta I'm very excited about, but these are passing all over the place. That's another way to bring some of these policies in. Everybody here, I'm sure, knows about food deserts and some of the policies in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. Great transportation solution. Rather than trying to figure out how to move all these people to where the food is, let's just bring the food to them. Often can be cheaper, often can be a more economic transportation solution. This is another example of ways that this gets affected. The state of Maryland had this existing social services building in Easton, Maryland. They were trying to figure out how to accommodate growing needs there and the fact that they were outgrowing this space. They thought this site near the airport would make an ideal location for social services, presumably because all their customers are arriving by plane. So this is the yellow was where the existing facility was. The proposed site was out there. Someone got the idea, I believe it was Governor Glenn Denning, a smart growth governor, to map where are their customers. Well, you can see where their customers are. This was obviously not thinking about exactly where their customers needed to be and creating an enormous transportation problem. With the governor's intervention, the site ended up being where the green arrow is. But without that intervention, without paying attention to the customers, to the transportation, to common sense, it would have gone out where it was easy for the social service providers to park. Now I want to move to a little bit more comprehensive approaches or just give a little more depth, and I'm going to run up on my time here. Kathy's giving me the 2 minutes. All right, so this gets 30 seconds. Complete streets, if you were in the last session, you know the importance of basically creating pedestrian facilities. It's really about making our thoroughfares places where everybody can go through and do it safely and comfortably. People want to bike more. People want to walk more. A lot of people don't drive to begin with, but they do pay property tax dollars to that transportation budget, so they ought to get the benefit of that. This is obviously not a complete street, but people are trying to use it that way, so they create these cow paths and basically with their feet indicate the demand that's out there. And then these are some of the elements that you want to make sure your complete streets policies provide for. Let me just say, you know, detractors will immediately try to have you putting a sidewalk out by a freeway. That is not what this is about. Don't be silly. So there are places that are passing these, both at the state level and at the local level. Oregon state law is, I think, a pretty good example where they're saying, you know, these places that we're constructing and we're going to take advantage of reconstruction opportunities to retrofit our facilities to make them safe for pedestrians, bikes, walking, transit, and as well as driving. It should work for everybody. And then the city of Chicago has also made this a big focus, and focusing particularly on that one-third of the population, the older folks, younger folks, people with disabilities, wanting to make a society and a city that worked for everybody. I also want to touch briefly on the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. This is, in my view, one of the most significant actions the federal government has taken on sustainable communities, on healthy communities in, you know, the last 40 years. And it's under the gun right now. It's a partnership between the three agencies listed up there. They've got guiding principles that basically are all about creating sustainable, walkable, healthy communities. They've got a number of different programs from the Sustainable Communities Planning Grants to the Tiger. We're now up to Tiger 3. Sorry, this slide is a little old. And EPA Smart Growth. There are serious budget decisions being made right now about all of these programs. Smart Growth America is doing everything we can to defend them. We need you to join us in advocating or to launch your own effort to advocate around these. But they are under attack, and they really need defense. And so if you want to help with that, please come up and give me your card afterwards. That would be terrific. We're organizing the defense, and we've been relatively successful in maintaining the budget in both of the last two rounds where the House voted to cut both times. Similarly, Transportation for America, we've had for a long time basically a federal transportation policy that's been stuck in the 1950s, all about building highways with little attention to pedestrian, biking, even transit until the 80s. And this bill is up for a new authorization. The Senate may take it up as early as next week. APHA is one of the executive committee members of Transportation for America. This is another place we need you to be active. There are serious threats to all of the transportation enhancements funding, which is the biking and walking funding. We need people to be active and to tell Congress, you know, these are real modes of transportation. They are protecting pedestrian and bicycle safety. There's disproportionate harm going to those communities, while at the same time, very little spending going there. And there are a number of other reforms that we're seeking in the transportation bill that will all move us in this direction. And with that, I will wrap up and thank you very much, Kathy, for having me up here and giving me the opportunity. Please give me your card and join us in fighting for these programs. Thank you.